Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, how to keep our nation's children safe at school. Last week, a student killed 10 people at a high school in Santa Fe, Texas. According to a tally being kept by CNN, that was the 22nd school shooting this year. So let's get right to it. This weekend, there were two calls for radical change. One came from the law enforcement community and the other from education. Art Acevedo is Houston's chief of police, and he posted on Facebook hours after the shooting, blaming the inaction of lawmakers to do something about gun violence. And Peter Cunningham is the executive director of Education Post and former assistant secretary for outreach and communications at the U.S. Department of Education. And he's calling for students nationwide to boycott. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Chief Acevedo, you're located about 40 minutes from Santa Fe, Texas. How is the community coping in the aftermath of the tragedy?
Well, you know, there's a lot of pain, as you can imagine, and shock and anguish. But at the end of the day, it's a small community, and it's a Texas community. It's a faithful community, and they know that they'll get through it. But people are hanging in there. I was at the hospital last night with Officer John Barnes, who retired from my department, and his beautiful wife, Ashley. And, you know, they're still struggling. He's got a long road ahead and still in need of prayers, as do we need to pray for the victims and their families as well.
And Chief, you wrote an impassioned Facebook post about the shooting, and I'll read just a part of it for our listeners who haven't had a chance to see it. In quote, you said, "The hatred being spewed in our country and the new norms we so-called people of faith are accepting is as much to blame for so much of the violence in our once pragmatic nation." Chief, tell us a little bit about why you wrote that and what the feeling was behind that.
Well, I mean, my heart aches, and because this is a nation that for 240 years we've been pragmatic. We've been the beacon of hope for the world. And the way that too many elected officials speak about people of color, about immigrants, about the other side of the aisle, it's just so contrary to what we have stood for as a nation, as a people, and as a people of faith, that is creating an environment that I believe, when you add mental illness and everything else that we're dealing with in this country, just adds fuel to the fire and can lead to people just doing things that we don't need to be having happen in our country. And so it's time for us to take a step back. We need to reset and go back to the norms that got us to become the greatest and most blessed nation on earth.
And Peter, you say that it's time for radical measures, including taking our kids out of school, right?
I do. I think that nothing has worked. We've seen shooting after shooting, 20 first graders in a school in Connecticut, you know, 17 kids in Florida, now 10 in Texas. It just goes on and on. 58 at a concert in Las Vegas. It's not just schools, it's churches. It's everywhere we have public life. And all this talk about hardening schools is, I think, a little bit ridiculous. There's no prohibition against putting a security guard in a school, but the last two school shootings had security guards. Are we going to harden recess and dismissal time? And we're going to harden our churches and our stores and parks? I just think the wrong direction. And my thought is that, you know, parents are a huge, huge potential force for good. And if they pulled their kids out of school for a day or two, maybe even a week in September, that would send a message to Congress and would remind them 2 months before the election that parents are serious and they want action.
I want to read a statistic here that stood out to me over the weekend. I felt like we as Americans are sending our children to war when they go to school. And in fact, the Washington Post had an analysis that showed that 29 people were killed in school shootings versus 13 in the military in 2018. Either of your reactions to that statistic?
It just makes me very angry, because every time these things happen, whether it's in a church, in a high school, in an elementary school, in a theater, all we see from people that their sole purpose in life should be, as elected officials, focusing on the safety and security of the American people, and most especially our children, and most especially people that are sitting at a church in prayer. And they do nothing other than come up to the cameras, act like they care. And you know what? Caring is not about words. Caring is about action. I'm tired of it. I think most of the people that I know, my friends that are conservative people, I've had a friend that's a lifelong NRA member, grandfather. His adult sons, lifelong NRA members, they're done. And so I'm hopeful that there's an awakening coming. But the problem is the longer it takes for all of us to wake up, the more people that are going to die needlessly, when I know in my heart of hearts there are things we can do, like background checks, making sure that at gun shows you can't be a private seller and just sell to anybody as long as they have money. We need to do our due diligence when we sell our guns to make sure we're selling it to someone that's of sound mind and law-abiding. And if that's too much to ask for you as a gun owner, then I think your priorities are not where they need to be.
Now, I want to bring in another issue here. We've talked a lot about politics and access to guns, but there is also, this is a uniquely American and or United States phenomenon, the school shootings, the death toll that we see. We are the most advanced country, I think, that has this level of school shooting. So to me, that indicates a social and cultural issue. I want to get both of your reactions to this ad from the NRA that came out over the weekend.
So when are we going to be completely honest and acknowledge the awkward, bullied, sexually frustrated, psychotropic, drug-laced, suicidal mass shooters in the room for what they are? Or are we just going to keep acting like we don't know what's going on in the name of not confronting the miserable reality that they are a creation of our so-called progressive culture and media?
Either of your reactions to that?
It sounds like a caricature up there to me. So now sexual frustration is what is the cause, right? Well, you know, I agree. There are a lot of psychological issues and mental health issues in our country, which means we need to do better at identifying people, having authority to temporarily or permanently remove firearms from the possession of these people. There's so many things that can be done. But the answer is not the NRA's answer, which is guns, guns, more guns, guns for everybody. Teachers need to teach, you know. But at the end of the day, it's not about the elected officials anymore. We have an initiative process, a ballot initiative process in our country, and I hope, starting in our state, with us in our city here, with the leadership of Mayor Turner, that we're going to mobilize the American people, because at the end of the day, they're the ones that are going to weigh in and make the difference.
Yeah, it strikes me as a ridiculous thing. It's just one more attempt to avoid talking about gun safety. They'd rather talk about any other issue. They want to talk about mental health. They want to talk about increasing security guards. They want to have fewer doors. I mean, there are reasons why we have multiple doors from schools. I think that's a fire hazard. So they'll do anything to avoid the topic of gun safety and the fact that we have easily accessible guns to people who shouldn't have them. That's not to say mental health isn't an issue and we shouldn't do more about it. But they're just avoiding the topic at hand, which is easy access to guns.
And aren't those two things almost, can't we believe in both of those things, that we need as a country to have certain regulations, gun regulations, background checks? Those things all do seem sensical, and yet also take a look at what's driving particularly young white men to commit these mass shootings. Can't we look at both of those things simultaneously?
It's not a zero-sum proposition. It's got to be comprehensive, it has to be pragmatic, and it has to be an all-hands-on-deck approach. If we can land a man on the moon, if we can land spacecraft on Mars, if we can create artificial intelligence, we can move this forward and we can impact this. Not to mention the fact we have safety standards for everything, from chairs to cars to planes to car seats. It's time for us to start telling the gun manufacturers we need to have intelligent triggers with biometrics so only the person that's lawfully owns or possesses that firearm can discharge it. There's a lot of things that can be done, but saying that there's nothing that can be done certainly is not the answer.
Chief Acevedo, I'm curious, the weapons that were used in the shooting were a shotgun and a 38 revolver. Those are not the focus of a lot of these gun control reforms where we're looking at AR-15s, et cetera, et cetera. How could gun reforms have impacted this particular incident?
Well, I think that those typically aren't the weapons of choice for most mass shooters and active shooters. But if we had strengthened laws that require us as gun owners to keep our firearms in a safe location, you know, there are criminal penalties if a child or a minor. But how about if it's your adult son or a neighbor or a friend that decides to grab a gun out of your house? We need to pass laws that holds gun owners accountable for their firearms, requiring them to keep them safe, locked up, secured. And so when there's many things that can be done, there's no 100% guarantee. But I can, the one guarantee I have is that if we don't do something, this is only going to continue. It's going to continue with more frequency. And at some point, the American people will wake up and do something about it.
And I guess I'd like to close, Peter, by asking you, and you too, Chief Acevedo, if you mentioned this earlier, the psychological impact this is having on children. I would argue it's having a psychological impact on anybody, on Americans who send their kids to school, who love children. I mean, this has just gotten out of control. And I wonder if there is a mass psychological shift that we're seeing where children are almost prepared that this could happen to them in schools.
There's no question that when you read the comments from kids, when you read articles about how kids are processing this, it's very much on their mind. And, you know, let's remember what schools are for. It's for learning. These kids are trying to get their education. They're trying to broaden their minds. They're trying to, you know, learn, you know, to become social and to make friends and to live in that special moment of time when you're in school and you're creating, you know, you're creative and you're doing things. And instead, they're doing active shooter drills. Instead, they're living in constant fear that somebody, some classmate, somebody is going to create, you know, a terrible situation and come in and kill them. That's an awful thing to put on children.
Chief Acevedo?
You know, it's heartbreaking when, as a father myself with a 10-year-old son, I've got to talk to him about where to sit in the theater, explain to him why we choose the seats that we do, or in a restaurant, what to do when they hear anything that sounds like gunfire, to not be curious, to go away from the gunfire, not towards the gunfire. It's just the times that we live in. But at the end of the day, I believe that there is an awakening going on, starting with the young people. And I'm really hopeful that we're going to get something done here very quickly.
Art Acevedo is Houston's chief of police, and Peter Cunningham is executive director of Education Post and former assistant secretary for outreach and communications at the U.S. Department of Education. Chief Acevedo, Peter Cunningham, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, your turn. What do you think we should do to prevent school shootings in this country?
I'm Maggie from Long Valley, New Jersey. More kids have died in school shootings this year than active military members in combat in 2018. Perhaps if we spent an equal amount of funding on education and school counseling, we wouldn't have kids bringing weapons of war with them to school.
My name is John, and I'm from Tampa, Florida. Other than the standard rhetoric, like raise the age of buyers, ban assault rifles, bump stocks, and multi-round magazines, all of which will certainly help, maybe the next thing is key card entrances, visitors being buzzed in, more resource officers on campus. Those are all good and reliable options.
My name is Michael, and I'm in Bloomington, Indiana. We need to stop looking for scapegoats, like laws and guns and games and entertainment. What it comes down to is that we don't take enough care of the people around us.
This is Devin calling from the Portland, Oregon area. I have considered homeschooling because of concerns about gun violence.
Add your voice to the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page. We'll be back with more after this on The Takeaway podcast. And hey, remember, we need your help. Go give us a review and ratings on iTunes. It helps spread the word. And thanks so much.
Hey, it's Alex, producer with The Takeaway, and we've got a question for you for tomorrow's show. And I'm talking to parents here. With shootings like Parkland, Santa Fe, and so many others, we want to know, from gun safety to mental health concerns, how are you addressing recent school shootings with your kids? Have you ever been worried about the risks that your own child might pose to his or her peers? Let us know by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE, and thanks.
The situation in Venezuela has been deteriorating for years. Hyperinflation, food shortages, and soaring unemployment are commonplace. But none of those were obstacles to Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, who won another six-year term, even as critics have widely denounced the vote as rigged. Mariana Zuniga is a journalist underground in Caracas, and she joins me now. Mariana, hello.
Hi.
So, you're there. Tell us what the last 48 hours has been like.
Well, as you just said, President Nicolas Maduro just won the presidency. He was elected for a second term. Critics said that the election was heavily rigged in his favor, maybe due to a mix of coercion, propaganda, and possibly fraud. In Caracas and around the country, the turnout was extremely low, probably the lowest for a presidential election ever. This was due to a call from many opposition leaders for a boycott of the vote, but also government supporters were disappointed because when we went to polling stations that were in strongholds that belongs to the government, they were empty as well. Like, some voting centers were completely empty, and some in some we found like few lines. And this is really, really weird for a presidential election in Venezuela that has always been fueled by a lot of passion, especially when ex-president Hugo Chavez was alive. He used to wake up a lot of passion on people. This campaign wasn't like that, and this election wasn't like that at all.
And two of the most prominent figures of Venezuela's mainstream opposition were barred from running in the election, right? What, yes. And there was talk of the opposition would boycott the election. Did that end up happening?
Yes, it ended up happening because many people didn't vote. Actually, I encountered many people that said, for me, this is another Sunday. I'm not going to waste my time. I already know what is going to happen. Because people, they don't believe in the institution that controls the elections in Venezuela. So they believe it was a waste of their time actually casting a ballot during these elections.
And the situation under Maduro, as we've seen, has been a humanitarian crisis. Is this continued leadership something that will now hopefully change things for Venezuelans or not? Because it's been awful.
It has been awful indeed. We actually, I think we're going to have really dark times in the next few months. More than 1 million Venezuelans have left the country in the past 2 years. And this exile probably will continue due to the re-election of Nicolas Maduro. People, they just can't cope with hunger, diseases, shortage of food, medicine, and now even water, because we're having heavy problems with water around the country as well. But the thing is, like, the country and the government is also running out of money. It is in a partial default. So it is difficult to imagine how President Maduro will end up his new term. Also, the United States says that it's considering further sanctions against Venezuela, including some possible oil embargo. Even though this option, according to some analysts, isn't the preferred option, since Venezuela is falling so quickly that every day is a more irrelevant supplier for the United States. So we could also expect some other sanctions towards individuals close to Maduro regime. But this also have some inconvenience because if this list expands, more officials will be will lose incentive to split from Maduro. So it's really difficult to imagine how the future in Venezuela will be and how they will continue coping with this crisis and if there's a possible or potential solution in the short term.
Mariana Zuniga is a freelance journalist in Caracas, Venezuela. Mariana, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
What happens when citizens try to escape their country's humanitarian crisis? By the end of this year, an estimated 3 million people will have left the country since 2015. That's one-tenth of Venezuela's population, and thousands of those people are taking the same path, crossing the Simón Bolívar International Bridge into the Colombian city of Cúcuta.
You've had hundreds of thousands of people cross into Colombia through that one point, into this rather small city, which is not an industrial city, and it really doesn't have the economy to absorb all these refugees coming in, and they can't find jobs, and that's what's largely created this refugee crisis right there in that spot.
Tim Padgett is the Americas editor for WLRN in South Florida. He traveled to Cúcuta this month to see firsthand how the city is grappling with the people who arrive each day.
Some go in just to find food and medicine and other basics, and then they return. Some go on to other countries like Ecuador or Peru, particularly if they have professional skills. But about a quarter of them, about 5,000 each day, stay there in Cúcuta, and they have become the mass of this refugee emergency.
You did end up speaking with a lot of Venezuelans who are leaving the country, and one of them was Zulema Villalba, who traveled earlier this year to Colombia with her family. And let's take a listen to what she said to you.
There is nothing left. No food, no medicine. Even if you can find it, you can't pay for it.
I mean, that's a pretty stark situation there, Tim.
Right. This particular woman and her family, they're from Maracay, Venezuela, not far from Caracas. They came from 500 miles away into Colombia because they started noticing that their three young children were seriously underweight. They weren't able to give them three square meals a day. And whatever wages they earned, I believe her husband is a mechanic, were just ravaged by hyperinflation there in Venezuela. So they've come to Cúcuta. They are trying to make ends meet every day by selling cell phone earbuds on the streets there. But it's not enough to meet both their needs for food and for shelter. And so I met them outside a church mission, as I recall, where they were trying to get registered for UN World Food Program food stamp benefits, because if they don't get those, they're afraid that they're going to have to start making very stark choices between food and shelter, and they'll have to end up sleeping on the streets.
And just so our listeners are aware, I mean, you mentioned this earlier at the beginning, but the situation in Venezuela right now is that there are supermarkets with completely empty shelves, folks who cannot get the medical attention or treatment that they deserve or need, right? I mean, this is pretty apocalyptic, it sounds.
Well, one of the things exacerbating that problem is that this dictatorial socialist regime that's in power in Venezuela right now, headed by President Nicolas Maduro, is in complete and utter denial about the crisis. And as a result, they have been rejecting most, if not all, of the international aid that has been offered them. And that's one of the things that is making this crisis so much more acute and pushing people out. And a lot of people really, I mean, consider that the real criminal act on the part of this regime. It's one thing to destroy your economy. It's another thing to reject the international aid that's coming to you in response to that calamity.
Now, you specifically were saying these folks are refugees because they're fleeing their country because of dire conditions there. But the United Nations has not declared the situation in Venezuela a refugee crisis. And you spoke to Joseph Merckx, who heads the Colombia operations for the United Nations Refugee Agency. And let's take a listen to what he had to say.
I prefer to call it a displacement crisis. We recognize there is a refugee dimension.
What is the difference, Tim, between a displacement crisis with a refugee dimension and just a refugee crisis?
Well, on the one hand, I understand the bind that the UN Refugee Agency is in. It has certain criterion protocol for how it designates bona fide refugee emergencies, refugee crises. For example, natural disasters, wars like the refugee crisis in Syria, for example. The problem that the UN is having with this, what officials there concede to us, is that they're having trouble labeling what this emergency really is. They admit that they really don't have a historical reference point for how to define this emergency because, on the one hand, it may not be as severe as the Syrian refugee crisis, but on the other hand, it's far worse than just a mere economic migration or displacement crisis, as Mr. Merckx referred to it as. And so I think there is a growing pressure, particularly among the Venezuelan expat community here in South Florida, to get the UN to register this as a formal refugee crisis, because even though people may not be fleeing bombs in Venezuela, they are fleeing a life-threatening situation when you're talking about lack of food and medicine and so many other basics you need to live. And they are hoping then that if the UN does register this as a formal refugee crisis, it will raise this situation's global profile and start leveraging a lot more international aid to these people.
And Tim, you've got a couple more parts of this series coming up. Can you tell us a little bit about what to expect there?
We'll be airing a report on how the South Florida Venezuelan diaspora here has been coming up with ways to aid these refugees. We have the largest Venezuelan community in the United States here in South Florida, and they have begun to pivot a lot of their aid that they have been sending for years now to Venezuela over to Cucuta because they realize that so many Venezuelans now are going into Colombia and are in that refugee situation, and they have to find ways to help those people more directly. And then our third part, we'll look at this 180-degree reversal of the situation between Colombians and Venezuelans. When I lived in Venezuela about a generation ago, the situation was the opposite. You had Colombians escaping a civil war and poverty in their country, coming into Venezuela as refugees. Now it's the other way around. You have Venezuelans coming into Colombia, and many Colombians are beginning to feel a little overwhelmed by this massive exodus of Venezuelans into their country. It's starting to create a bit of resentment. And for example, on May 27th, we have an election, a presidential election in Colombia, in which it looks like the conservative candidate will be the winner of at least the first round because of this anti-immigration sentiment that's beginning to bubble up in Colombia because of this Venezuelan refugee crisis.
Important story, and we'll be sure to pay attention to that. Tim Padgett is the America's editor for WLRN. Thank you for being with us, Tim.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Next up on The Takeaway, we're talking about the massive market for high-tech educational toys. And we asked you, are these products helping?
My name is Tina. I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri, and my grandchildren are 7 and 4 years old. The older is a boy, and he is on the autism spectrum. And without technology available to him, he would not have been able to express his needs and wants completely. It's changed his life for the better. Also, our world is advancing and making technological changes, and daily the children need to be comfortable in that environment and not afraid.
This is Emily Dickerson in Portland, Oregon. High-tech toys are making parents and kids lazy. We are pawning our children off on these devices rather than spending quality time with them. So look forward 20 years. I think we're going to have a society of adults who have difficulty occupying themselves and thinking for themselves and dealing with boredom. Boredom is really, really important for the brain. My daughter's smart and she's happy and she's creative, all without access to phones and all these other devices.
More ahead on the benefits of educational toys. Stay with us.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to The Takeaway. We say it a lot, but we really mean it. Our listeners are the most important part of our show. We want to hear from you. Jump into the discussion on our Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. We retweet and keep listening. Thanks again.
Here's a big money number for you. $4 billion a year. That's billion with a B. And that's the market for educational toys in the United States. You know, the kind that make your kid or your grandkid or your friend's kid a genius.
My name's Kayla and yours is Abby.
She understands you.
Our revolutionary technology, we're ready to be your child's best friend.
We're lost in the rainforest.
With revolutionary technology that learns and grows with your child.
Let's learn something new.
Snuggle up to learning with more than 15 activities that teach first words, animals, and more.
You probably purchased one of these toys for a child in your life. I know I have. But the real question is, do they deliver what they advertise? Will they supercharge your baby? And for a child to play and learn, are batteries required?
It's a somewhat uniquely American thing, this need to have a, you know, sort of genius children. And it's even in the names of the of some of the products like Leapfrog or Einstein, you know, these things that that really tell you if your kid's not ahead, he's falling behind.
Eric Vance is a science writer, and his new article for Scientific American is called Can You Supercharge Your Baby? It reveals what the research really says about the benefits of educational toys and whether the emphasis on your child developing first really matters.
When you talk to child psychologists, what they say is completely different from what you get from the marketing around a lot of these toys. You know, child psychologists, they don't think about doing things early or making genius children. You know, they're much more interested in the natural progression. And so I was talking to this child psychologist, and he was telling me about his own experience with this. And when he was in a store trying to get a teething ring for his kid, and found this teething ring, and it said it promotes oral, motor, and language development. And
this, that sounds pretty impressive ring. For a teething ring.
Right, it's a teething ring, and he and his wife are world experts on developmental psychology, and they're like, I don't even know what oral motor development is. And of course it's not really a thing, and it's certainly not a thing attached to teething rings. But that's, everything has to promote development or make your kid smarter or move him ahead. And I feel like a lot of things today can't just be a toy or a teething ring.
Are these products actually supercharging babies?
Overwhelmingly, I found the answer to be no. If you want your kid to read early or to talk early, there's not a lot of evidence that you can do that. And there's no evidence that that has any lasting effect on the child's development or success in life. And so I sort of took this from a few different angles, a few different products. And for all of the concern we have, for talking is a great one. When does he talk? Well, my kid start talking at 9 months. For all of our concern about this, it doesn't really mean anything for the kid or the adult that he'll become. And so a lot of these products seem to be promising something that doesn't, or trying to promote something that doesn't necessarily tie to later development. And there are a lot of things that do tie to later development, but it doesn't seem like that's a needle that can be moved, and certainly not in the first couple of years.
So obviously, this is a big business, though. Most parents want to see their kids succeed. What are these marketers and these toy manufacturers tapping into when it comes to parents?
I mean, if there's anything that we care about more than our own health, it's the health or the success of our child, right? And I think that it's such a powerful desire that you can't help but just not only want it, but also be worried about whether or not you're doing it wrong. I looked at a lot of products, and I looked at the science behind a lot of these products, and I can tell you honestly, almost all of them I considered buying myself as I researched them. Even if they clearly didn't do anything, that insecurity is very powerful, that desire to get something that might help your kid.
Well, now we talk about truth in advertising. Are there any legal limitations to what these products can promise?
Well, there are. And the primary regulator there would be the FTC. And I wrote about one case that the FTC got involved in when there were promises about, actually it was called Your Baby Can Read. And the promise was obviously to teach babies as young as a few months old how to read. But the thing is the FTC, they could spend all day, every day, just doing this, and they simply don't have the resources at the time. They have a lot of things to focus on, all sorts of false advertising. So the reality is that companies have a lot of leeway, a lot more, I think, than the average reader would assume. I think we assume that there's some sort of check on what products can promise, and I didn't really find that beyond some very egregious cases. It's kind of up to the advertiser to say what their product does.
This seems to be, when we talk about things like this and buying toys for your kids and the best toys or the best developmental tools, isn't there an economic component there? Like, poorer families just can't afford to get in this game at all?
This is a huge point. When you talk to the scientists who study this, that's what the overwhelming majority of them are interested in things like the 30 million word gap, where certain kids, hear fewer words by the time they're 4 years old. And a lot of these toys are premised on ideas that are trying to address issues, these systemic problems in our culture, where there are kids who aren't getting enough engagement. They're not getting enough stimulation. But stimulation is a little like vitamins or food. You need enough, but more isn't necessarily better. You don't, if you take extra, and most kids who are not in really stressful homes are getting enough engagement, especially in the first couple of years, they're getting enough stimulation. But there are, kids in poorer neighborhoods, kids so lower socioeconomic status and more stress in their home, has a huge effect on a lot of developmental benchmarks. And that's where I think a lot of the science is. But that doesn't necessarily translate to, you know, creating a blinking caterpillar that can teach your child how to do coding. You know, like this is, there's sort of a disconnect there. But that first issue is very important. And it's a systemic problem in our country.
And it seems like, I think back to things like Sesame Street that were created initially, at least, to help to close that gap. But that was a, you know, that was public television. That was something that was available specifically for low-income kids, I think, to have access to these types of learning tools. But this sounds more like you can either afford to buy the caterpillar with the blinking lights that teaches you how to code, or you can't.
And what I think what we're seeing is that the people who buy them are not necessarily people who need them. And also, the way that these things are created has also created a lot of concern among scientists, especially with the pace that they run at. If you watch an old Mr. Rogers episode, and there's a scientist who's worked on this a lot named Dimitri Christakis, he goes really slowly. You know, everything he does is really almost infuriatingly slow. But he's working at the pace of real life. Today, a lot of these products, a lot of these videos go very fast. And it may have effects on a child's development, how their cognitive development goes along, because they're pacing themselves to a world that isn't really real.
There's so much to talk about there, particularly when it comes to screen time. But that's probably for another conversation. Eric Vance, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Eric Vance is a science writer and author of the book Suggestible You, The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal.
This is Barbara Anderson from Brownsville, Oregon. I do not agree with high-tech toys making kids smarter. I think they actually make them less creative, less able to entertain themselves without that toy. And I believe that overall they stunt their imaginations at a critical time when they needed to be developing those so they can be successful later in life. Important skills to have.
This is Paul Reinhertz calling from Vallejo, California. Toys do not make a person smarter. On the other hand, I am a university observer in middle and elementary schools. Technology is a huge adjunct for the intelligence a child already possesses. Information and experience are the aspects of a child's life that enhances their native intelligence.
What's your experience with educational toys? Tell us your story at The Takeaway's Facebook page or hit us up on Twitter at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for talking with me today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.